Welcome. This is Jean Maroney of Thinking Directions. And today I'm offering a free teaser class on the topic of the psychology of ambition. I think this is a really interesting topic. You know, for those of you who know my business, the main business I have is a membership program called the Thinking Lab. And the main thing we do in the Thinking Lab is help ambitious people go after their goals. And I thought this would be a great topic to share some real advice for people who have ambitious goals and also give you the flavor of what the kind of thing that we do in the Thinking Lab. To put this in perspective, I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing when we talk about a goal. A goal is an intention you set to achieve a particular outcome. This is something out in the real world. It needs to be something that wouldn't come to pass without intentional effort. So if you have, you know, brush your teeth, unless there's some risk that you're not going to brush your teeth, that is not a goal you set. It's something you might do intentionally, but you don't set it as a goal because you just do it. It's part of your routines. I think it's important not to put everything that you do intentionally on a list as if it's a goal. No, a goal is something that gets a special intentional effort from you, because it would not happen without some planning, some moving forward, some actually dealing probably with problems as you go. And so it's also not just what you desire. So one of the things I talked about in one of the ads I sent out for this was some people, I think, have a real longing to change the culture, but they don't set any goals around it. And a goal to change the culture, to do something that would actually change the culture, is a very ambitious goal. But just wanting it doesn't make it a goal. It only becomes a goal when you actually try to figure out some outcome that you are going to work to achieve. And the problem with something as broad as a longing to change the culture or, you know, do something great or invent something interesting is that it's so vague, it doesn't actually give you a direction. To turn it into a goal, you need to figure out something real that you are going to work to make turn into reality. That sentence has too many reals and reality in it, but it's not just something that happens in your head. And this is something that I've done a lot of work on: how do you set goals so that you can actually achieve them? And this turns out to be one of the most important things. People often set goals that are really learning goals, and they don't work that well because it's not objective enough when you're finished. It's the way to really set goals is to set something that's going to happen in the world as a result of your effort. Now, as a means to that end, you may need to learn a lot, but the outside goal is what makes it objective. For example, I have done a whole lot of work on developing a skill at writing, but I did it through having written a number of things. And for each thing that I wrote, I needed only to develop enough skill to write that item. Now, over the course of 30 years, I've developed a lot of skill, but I did it. The reason I did that was because I have these real world results. If you just sit in a corner and try to think about something without real world results, like never show anyone you're writing, for example, you can't actually develop that skill. So you need real world outcomes, not just an idea in your mind. That's very important to a goal. Now, what makes a goal ambitious? I think it needs to be long range. And I think it's something that, in fact, will require you to develop your capabilities. So it's not, if it's just something that is, you know, there's a blueprint for it, you just need to do this and 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 this, and you know exactly what to do, that's great. And that's a goal. And by all means, set those goals, get those results, accomplish that. But a truly ambitious goal is something that you're going to need to grow in order to achieve. And these are some of the most important goals that you set, because they really shape your life. They actually, you get the most pride out of a goal that you set that is challenging to you in this way, that in fact, you're not sure how to do it, and you're going to need to develop new knowledge or learn new skills or maybe strengthen your values in order to do it. when you know, when you go into something knowing that you don't have all the capacity to do it, like I did, you know, I've been working on writing for a long time because I wanted to write a book. Okay, that's an important goal, and it definitely was something that was, you know, too hard for me. I mean, I've been working on books for a while, and it's definitely was something that was beyond my capacity. I don't think it is anymore. I'm working on a book I think is going to really happen. But when you do that, you should expect that there will be unforeseen setbacks and difficulties and failures that you're going to need to pick yourself up from. You know that you don't have the capabilities. You don't want that to stop you. You want that to inform how you go about pursuing it. That's why, like in the case of writing, I mean, I actually learned to writing 400 and 800 word pieces, and then they went up to 2000. And I've done that, and then it went up to speech length. So we're talking like 4,500 words. And now I'm at a level where I can write chapters of books. That was something that had to evolve. It had to evolve based on what I could do. When you set an ambitious goal that you can't yet do, part of what the commitment is that you're going to develop that ability. You're going to do what it takes. F.M. Alexander has a term, he calls it the means whereby. You are committed to learning the means whereby, and part of that is your own psychology. If you do not yet have the capabilities, capabilities are in effect mental, this means you are going to change your mind. You're going to literally change your value hierarchy, or literally develop new skills that you didn't have, or literally organize knowledge, or induce new knowledge that nobody has. You are going to do some of that in order to achieve this goal. And of course, the more ambitious it is, and the less likely there's a blueprint. And in particular, the more unique it is, the less likely there's a blueprint. I think the only way you can really achieve a really ambitious goal is that it be highly selfish. And selfish here, I always mean rationally selfish. I don't mean, oh, this would show up other people, or, oh, this would be better than other people. It's got nothing to do with second-handedness. It's got nothing to do with other people. It has to do with you seeing this is in my rational self-interest. This is essentially a rational goal. And this is very, very meaningful to me. I care about this. And that, when an ambitious goal is personally meaningful to you, it tends to be very unique. You know, writing a book is not unique, but the kind of book I want to write is very unique. It has to do with my interest in how you manage a mind, and specifically the application of things I've learned about epistemology to understanding psychology. It's a very small niche, and it's very personal to me and my own intellectual development. It's not a coincidence it's taken 30 years to write. One of the reasons I know the things I know about psychology is because 34 years ago, I realized my thinking wasn't as good as I thought it was. I was, what's that? What's that? And I went on a mission to fix it. And that is what has informed everything I've learned since then. And that's why my book is going to be different from someone else's book on a similar subject, because it's very unique to me. This is why I say in the material for this, I said that if you have an ambitious goal, you actually are going to need to understand your own psychology, because the uniqueness of your ambitious goal is going to be very wrapped up in you and what goes on in your mind. I've now spent quite a bit of time for your aunt. Well, I've had the goal since 1990 in some form or other. Okay, how do you achieve this? And there was a lot of trial and error. And I found there are two really key ingredients. And they both involve rational selfishness. The first is you need a rational goal setting methodology, a rationally selfish goal setting methodology. This is something some of you have been to some of my other teasers. I have another teaser called Set Goals That Motivate. If you search on my website, you can find Set Goals That Motivate. This is the teaser for my launch program. And one of the things I talk about there is it's not enough that the long range goal be really selfish. So like my long range goal at this point is to teach adults how to think clearly and logically about value laden issues. And, you know, that is a real world thing. People actually learn how to do this. That's what my long range goal is. But that's perfectly fine as far as a rational goal, but I need to turn that into something I'm doing this week where I actually see a payoff from it. So like this class, I'm hoping to actually teach some people something about how to think clearly and logically about value-laden issues, but it's a very specific thing in a particular class with particular people. And I'm motivated for this because this particular topic, I had to figure out a topic that I found new and interesting. I'm probably not going to do set goals that motivate again because I've already given it like 6 times. And I'm just not that interested in that topic anymore because I have a script for it. You know, it's just not that interesting to do it again. In order for me to get behind and actually give a great class, I need to have something new and interesting to say. And that's why this is the topic today. This is an example of rational goal setting, is that you don't just say, well, it would be perfectly logical. Years ago, I did probably 15 times, I did a class called Jumpstart Your Thinking, which was a good class. I did the exact same class for 15 times. I finally got completely sick of it, right? And I am willing to bet money that the last three of classes were way worse than the first three, even though I knew more, because I wasn't as motivated. This is something I had to learn. I had to learn you've got to have every step of the way be selfish. You need to bring that motivation in, which gets to the second point. It's not just the goals, because the goal you set is very relevant to that. You don't want any of the steps along the way, you don't want any of the main key results. These are things that take a couple of weeks at a time, or the tasks, things that take a couple hours at a time. You don't want any one of them to be just a chore. You want every one of them to have some kind of a selfish payoff, so you get pride and satisfaction the whole way through. You can have, you know, little tiny tasks that are just boring and repetitive, but it better be that within about 2 hours, something about that, about how you do it, makes it pay off for you. So for example, something like clearing my email inbox, right? This is something that it's got some interesting things in it. Well, one of the things that I do is I do it in passes. So no matter what, if I can do in 15 minutes, I can actually do one pass. And is it satisfying to finish a pass? Yes. This is a very small payoff, but it is part of how I make sure I clear my email, is I do it in a way that I don't feel like I'm completely overwhelmed. I then, you know, I categorize them for how to go back to them so I can do it in an efficient way. I get pleasure out of doing it efficiently. Someone else wouldn't feel that way. This has to do with my particular things that I find, I find efficiency interesting. I like completion. And I found a particular way for processing my email that works for me because of my values. This is always very unique. People, I like to say there's no one size fits all solution for managing your life or managing your days. If you guys have time management systems, this is something I'd like to talk about too. Everybody's time management system is a little different and it needs to work for you. I mean, just for example, some people, as soon as they make a plan, they start not wanting to work on it. Okay, if that's where you are right now, you should not make plans the way that is advised everywhere else. If that doesn't work for you, you need to find some other thing that does work for you. So having a list of things and doing the thing that seems to matter most works for some people rather than making a plan and putting it in order. Now, you may find, I found that structuring a week didn't work for me at all. But then at a certain point in my business, I decided I actually needed to get more organized and I needed to work on schedule and know what I was going to do each week. And it took me about 2 years to develop the knowledge, skills, and values to be able to do that reliably. But I had figured out that I wanted to do it for my business. And so it was selfishly important for me. And at that time, I developed that skill. But for, 25 years before, I did other ways to manage my time and manage my projects. And I think that's very important. If you want to be able to keep making progress, you need to take into account what works for you, and only you can figure that out. And the reason you need to do this is you need to be motivating yourself selfishly. Every time you try to do something out of duty, every time you do something, try to do something because this is logical, I just have to do it. Every time that happens, you are actually making it more difficult to succeed over the long run. You can make yourself do stuff. You can hunker down and do work in the short term. That's what I did probably for my first 10 years. That was the only way I knew of getting myself to do stuff. But the effect of that is burnout. It doesn't work over the long run. And so the big thing that I've developed in the motivation area is figuring out how do you tap into that selfish motivation. Ultimately, you need to not only be able to access your own selfish motivation, you need to be able to strengthen it. And that's the kind of thing that we teach in the Thinking Lab. The really key point here is that in order to achieve an ambitious goal, you're going to need to know enough about your psychology to be able to access rationally selfish motivation. The whole process of pursuing an ambitious goal is built or has to be built around rational selfishness. Otherwise, you just won't be able to make it over the long haul. Now, I'm curious if everybody's with me so far. I've told you what I think goals are. I've told you what I think ambitious goals are. I've made a case for this. You can put it in the chat. Is everybody with me? Give me some people who are on video. You can put a thumbs up. Okay. Looks like we're together. Okay, great. Well, this gets to kind of the interesting thing that I wanted to talk about here, which is what do you need to know about yourself? This is why I called it the psychology of ambition. What do you need to know about your own psychology? And the big thing you need to know about your own psychology is you need to know your own old baggage. So this is I deliberately use this kind of unscientific colloquial term, old baggage, to mean any kind of defensive motivation. So you may have a lot of words for that. You may have heard of limiting beliefs or self-defeating beliefs, or you might have heard of defense values or defense mechanisms. Or if you've heard some of my other stuff, you may have heard of anti-values or compulsions or, sometimes people have labeled themselves as procrastinators or perfectionists. They're all kind of analyses, shall we say, of psychological, I'm going to just put quote marks around it, psychological problems that seem to get in the way of living a happy, productive life. And people, let's face it, the clinical psychology books, there's a whole industry in making up names for all of the problems that people can have, right? Of all the ways they can get a little miswired and messed up. And I actually think it's not that that's a bad thing per se. I do think it's kind of misconceptualized the way it's done, but that's not the essential problem. I mean, there is an issue of how do you actually characterize psychological issues in the most fundamental way. The real problem with this kind of identification of psychological problems is that when people realize, oh, I have ADHD. Oh, I'm a second-hander. Oh, I am a perfectionist. They tend to view it as, well, this is just the way I am. And then, okay, well, then I can't do, there are a bunch of things I can't do because this is the way I am. And I think that that is actually the problem. Is the problem is a lot in looking at it as, oh, this is the way I am. It's true that you actually do need to know about this. If you are to pursue an ambitious goal, like me, my big problem with writing was subjectivity. I mean, this is a serious problem that I'm just going to give an example that my husband harassed me about for years. When I first met him, he asked what I did. I said I worked on wavefront sensors. And he said, what's a wavefront sensor? I said, well, you take a collimated beam. And I went off, you know, rattled off, and he just laughed because he didn't know what a collimated beam was. And that was, you know, I mean, it made no sense, right? You don't need to know what a collimated beam is. You don't need to know what a wavefront sensor is. It's the point is, I didn't know how to explain what I was doing in a way that someone I was talking to could really understand it. And I was so caught up in my own mind that it just wasn't obvious to me what I knew and what they knew and how to bridge that difference. And that's why it's taken me 30 years to really learn to write at a level that I'm satisfied at, which I'm very proud of, actually. But part of the problem is, if you have that problem, you say, oh, well, then I guess I can't write, which is the kind of thing that a lot of people do. They say, oh, my writing's not good enough. I guess I should not go into that direction. And that's not what I did. And that's not what I recommend you do. If you have something that you're really passionate about, you can learn the skills, right? You can, no matter how big the goal is, you can find things that you can do in the short term. This is the rational goal setting process that in fact get some of the meaning of the big long range goal while also developing your skills as you go on. And so it's important not to, once you identify that you have like some, let's say, misintegration or lack of integration in your memory banks or among your values or in your knowledge or whatever it is, it's important that you don't say, oh no, this is terrible. This is what's wrong with me. It's important you don't take that approach. It's important instead to look at that as, gee, huh, yes, I'm going to need to work around that, but you can actually take advantage of the way things have been misprogrammed. And I think, in fact, you know, there's always a story as to why you're programmed the way you are. And it's helpful to have some idea of how, you know, how you program the way you are. You're not a passive, it's not passively programmed. It's from the result of your past choices and actions. Part of the reason that I was programmed, I had the problems I had, was that I was never held to high standard as a child. You know, in school, I got straight A's really easily, and they just gave me an A, and I never really got that much feedback of, Gene, you need to be more precise here. Gene, you know, they just never held me to a standard. And that had a really unexpected effect, you know, on my psychology, which I know now I shouldn't blame the educators for that, although I did at first. Now it's like, oh, okay, now I understand. The fact that it was easy for me and I didn't get any feedback meant this is sort of how I turned out this way. But it did have an effect on me that made me realize how I was mad. I was, as a result of this, as a result of this effect, I was mad that my mind didn't function as well as I thought it could function. And that anger at, you know, directed at my mind not working as well as it should, is what motivated a whole lot of work. Is that, okay, I'm going to do something about this. Now, you can tell from how I opened, that was not a good way to set the goal, right? That set me up as trying to fix a broken mind. But the truth is that it did provide some motivation. And I think that's the right way to look at old baggage. Not that this is actually an additional source of motivation. If you're annoyed about something about your mind that doesn't function the way you want it, good. When you now need to learn a skill that's going to challenge that, you can bring in a little bit of that anger to help you say, okay, so how am I going to learn this? And that can be very helpful for you to get over humps. So this is like a complete shift on old baggage. Instead of saying this is something that holds you back, this is part of how you're going to tap into some selfish motivation to launch you through something that might be difficult. The other thing that I think is important is that if you have, I mean, everybody on this call, most of the people on this call are, well, everybody's an adult. You know, I mean, everybody is at least in college, right? You're all adults. And, you know, you have had some trials and tribulations, and often those are related to the old baggage. Like if you have a problem with PTSD, I mean, that's because you had some trauma in your, you know, somewhere in your history, which is a big deal and can definitely affect your pursuit of goals. But I think it's also helpful to realize that your strong values have also been shaped by whatever weird path you have taken with whatever trials and tribulations. So, for example, another thing that I found when I was, basically when I read The Fountainhead, I discovered that I had a kind of second-handed streak. Now, in hindsight, I actually, you know, this is a perspective I only got recently, and I read The Fountainhead in 1984. So it was the second book of Ayn Rand's I read. And if you don't know The Fountainhead, I recommend you read it. It's a book on whose theme is independence. And some of the characters are very second-handed. And I saw little pieces of myself in them, and I was very upset. Now, in hindsight, my willingness to say, gee, what's that about me? I don't want to be like that guy. I want to be like that guy. That was actually a very healthy reaction. But it left me worried for a while. Well, what I discovered is that because I had been focused on other people, this actually developed my skill at empathy. Because I had been somewhat second-handed, I had paid more attention to other people than some people who are more first-handed. And this skill at empathy is actually very helpful for me now as a coach. Now, I do it now for a completely first-hand reason. I want to understand the person. I want to understand their values so that whatever advice I give them or whatever information I give them is actually going to be helpful for them to proceed rationally. But I actually developed that skill partly because of mistakes I made in my childhood. So whatever mistakes you made, you still, if you were going after things, you developed real values, even if you did them to some extent for the wrong reason, and to some extent using perhaps, you know, motivation by fear or other kinds of things. You have values that you have formed from everything you've done, including things that you've done in hindsight that didn't make sense, that you disagree with. You have developed skills, even if they were skills that were, in hindsight, were not the best skills. You wish you had done something different. And you have developed knowledge. Like, you have developed knowledge, even if they're on topics that, in fact, you wish you didn't know. Like, for example, maybe you were raised, I have someone in the thinking lab who was raised religious, is not religious anymore, but he has used his knowledge of how he was raised to actually go on to do some work to try to teach people what the risks are of raising a child religious. I mean, that's his point of view, and that's what he has done. And so this is things that he learned as a child that he doesn't even agree with now, he is actually using to help on a mission that he is to try to get more rational parenting processes happening. So your history is part of what makes you unique. And everything that makes you unique is part of how you can figure out a really ambitious goal that is unique for you, that is uniquely meaningful to you. So I don't think you should be afraid of your old baggage. I think people sometimes are really upset to discover that they've got, you know, they've got some defensiveness or whatever it is that they discover that's wrong about them. And a much healthier perspective is that you're shaped by both the things you did well and the mistakes you made. And I'm not saying it's not bad to have made a mistake. I'm saying that you still were growing, even if you were off if you weren't in the best perspective. And that's what you need to look at. This is part of how you take a value-oriented perspective on yourself. You really stay focused on the strengths of what you developed, even when things maybe you don't approve of what you did. Doesn't mean you're not going to decide that that was wrong. It doesn't mean you're not going to, you know, make a change. If you did something you think was really morally wrong, you're going to actually make a change. You're going to make amends and you're going to change your mind about that and you're going to figure out how to not do that again. But it doesn't mean that you have to, you don't go into infinite self-excoriation as a result of that. And in fact, all the motivation you have can help add urgency to an ambitious goal. So what I recommend, if you have some stuff in your psychology that you don't approve of, is don't go on a mission to fix yourself. This is something I try to do, and it is totally demoralizing. For a couple of reasons. First of all, if you have, you know, like I had a problem with subjectivity or with secondhandedness, how do you know that that's fixed? You know, you can't just, you know, take an inventory of your psychology. You can't do that. I mean, how do you do that? I don't know how to do that. And I've been really studying introspection for a long time. What happens is you get yourself into a new situation and you either act, like take secondhandedness, you either act independently or secondhandedly. And which are the ones you're going to notice? Are you going to notice when you act independently? Or are you only going to notice if you suddenly, oh yeah, I'm focused on what other people think instead of reality here. You're only going to notice the times when you're secondhand. So you're only going to notice the cases where you're not as first-handed as you thought. It's actually difficult to notice that you're doing the right thing. What really happens with these things is it becomes less and less and less. There's, you know, I rarely find myself focused on other people instead of reality these days. But it still happens from time to time. And when it happens, my reaction is, oh, okay, good to notice. Okay, where's reality here? Where's reality here? How do you find reality here? Well, that's something I've thought about. I actually, my husband is Harry Binswanger. Some of you may know that. And I got to know him as his student, having philosophical consulting with him. And one of the early questions I asked him is, okay, when I go into these objectivist club meetings, I immediately get into this totally secondhand state. I'm like, should I sit next to that person? Well, what will they think? What will they think? And I know it's secondhanded, but I don't know, how do I look at reality here? What do I do? I knew that what I was doing couldn't be right, but I didn't know what the positive was. And he said, this is really important. Do what's selfish. Go sit by the person you want to sit with. In a case like this, it doesn't matter where you sit. It really is optional. And this is a case where ask yourself, well, who do I want to sit with? Gets you in touch with some selfish values. And I did that. I remember the relief at the next meeting I went to. And I thought, who do I want to sit with? I wanted to sit with Jim. And I went and sat with Jim. And I was so happy to be able to sit next to the person who I wanted to sit next to. It was great. It made the whole meeting better for me. And that's the kind of thing that you want to have if you catch, gee, I'm being subjective here. Okay, what do these people need to know? Do they need an example? Do they need me to back up? Do I need to check in and see if they can tell me what it is they need to know? It's when you catch things like this, it just means you now know something about that issue and you are going to need some tactic or method to then deal with it in that moment. And that's all right. Those are learnable skills. Those are learnable skills. So I guess I didn't completely make clear why it's not good to go on a mission to fix yourself. So the problem is, if you go on a mission to fix yourself, you never finish. So it's always, oh, I've put in all this time and still look at me, look how subjective I am. Or, oh, I put in all this time, look at me, look how second-handed I am. It's like, it's totally demoralizing. You need, as part, particularly if you have an ambitious goal, but just for happiness, you need to be seeing your success, and your success needs to be objective. And this is not something you can do about something that's in your head. And so these kinds of things, what you want to do is you want to set a goal that is a stretch goal that you think you can get, you know, and, you know, bring something down to what you can do today, this week, in 2 weeks, whatever, related to your goal that you can actually do, and then solve the actual concrete problems associated with that goal. And you will get tremendous pride, tremendous sense of efficacy, and you will build confidence, and you will get so you can solve whatever problems they are and at the rate that you need to solve them in order to succeed. The corollary of this is you need a real world goal to help you untangle old baggage. And this is, I mean, this is my point of view. And I won't say it's unique to me, but I do think I stress this in a way that other people don't stress this. I think this is an object, to me, this is an issue of objectivity. This is an issue of applying an objective epistemology to the problem of setting goals and to the problem of knowing yourself. The only thing you can see objectively is what happens in the world. The introspection is, I don't think that statement was made quite right, but the thing that's objective is the results you get in the world. And we all know the fact you tried, you know, doesn't cut it. It's what actually happened that really matters. And if you stay focused on, well, what your intentions were and what you tried to do, you know, I mean, it's trite, but it crossed my mind. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. It's not about the intentions. It's about actually doing things in reality. And I think this sometimes intimidates people because they have big, ambitious goals and they don't know how to go after them. And when they try to go after them, they fail. This is why you need a rational goal setting process that can help you break that down into something you can do now. This is why you need to know how to activate rational motivation. So if you have something that you think would be good in theory, how do you actually get yourself to actually want to take the steps that need to be taken today? This requires a tremendous amount of introspection, and you need introspective skills. How many people have been taught introspective skills? I mean, you know, maybe people on this call, because you're all interested in thinking directions. You got, I hope, my thinking directions starter kit. And if you didn't, you should get my thinking directions starter kit. It's got some introductory material on introspection. It's free. It's on the website. It's the pop-up. It's the annoying pop-up that comes up. Or if you just look on the menu, one of the things at the right is called freebie, and that's the thinking directions starter kit. But what happens is if you keep setting goals and acting toward real things in the world, yes, psychological issues will come up, but they will come up in the context of something small that you are trying to do. I've hired a marketing team to help me with marketing my business. And I realized, we're having a problem. We don't seem to have enough communication about when things need to happen when. They don't know enough about my business to know that they need to consider this, 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 and this if we're going to do a campaign for like this psychology of ambition webinar. So I have now as a task on my list, I talked with Susie, my assistant. We got a short list. I'm going to be making a template for everything we need to talk to them about in order to offload, based on having had now three things that we tried to get them to market that didn't quite work. It's like, huh? We still haven't figured this out. I thought they were going to figure that out. Apparently, they're not going to figure it out. Well, I need to figure it out if they're not going to figure it out. And so, you know, and so now this, the idea of marketing you know, of really marketing my business better. This has been something that has intimidated me for years. It's one of the reasons I hired them. But now, instead of trying to solve every problem in the world, what I'm trying to do is figure out what is the list of things I need to tell them so they can market the next thing really effectively. That's a much smaller problem. I'm not nearly as intimidated by that. And I've got these people who are now, I mean, part of the reason I hired them is I think they can be a resource in helping me figure out how to do this, that it won't take as much time for me. So, you know, it's now it's a doable goal because I have a real world thing. I'm going to have a list that that I can go through with this team. Step by step, there are going to be words on the list. It's going to be out there in reality. And that's how I'm going to solve this problem. And as part of this, have I had to deal with some of my, oh no, it's not working. I hired the wrong people. All kinds of self-doubt. Of course I did. So what? Self-doubt is an alert that you need to go look here because you're actually very concerned about what's going on. It doesn't mean, oh no, I don't have any self-esteem. Oh no, I totally screwed up. That's not what it means. It's an alert, or the right way to think about it, I think, is an alert. Huh, okay, there's something I really need to learn here because I'm feeling like I'm not being very efficacious. Okay, so what's going on? What can I do about that? And because it's a real world goal, and in this case, you know, a small real world goal that I can finish by Tuesday, right? It's not so overwhelming. I don't have to solve all the problems in the world. I can solve this problem. And I assure you, working through this problem is making, is part of how I will develop a real expertise on this. Audrey says, self-doubt is a piece of the full context. It's one of the emotions, right? So self-doubt is an emotion. And the way I think you should think about emotions is that they are alerts to values at stake. And self-doubt is a particularly unpleasant one. I mean, one of the theories of defense mechanisms is that they're simply a means to avoid self-doubt because it feels so bad. So like if you think you did something wrong, it's so much easier to feel so much better to blame someone else. So that's what hostility and projection are, right? Is that you kind of screwed up and you feel guilt and self-doubt. You think, oh no, you should have done this. You screwed up. And you don't have to feel that guilt and self-doubt. And that's where some defense mechanisms operate. But the truth is, what you want to do is you want to feel that, oh, what am I feeling self-doubt about? Oh boy, that does feel terrible. What exactly are the facts? What exactly are the actions I took? What exactly do I wish I had done more thinking about? What do I wish I had figured out last week instead of this morning, right? And if you can look at that with humor and benevolence, you can go far. So the self-doubt is a lead. It's an emotion. So it's not cognitive yet, but it's a lead to some facts and values that you need to get out. You need to actually activate that full context in order to figure out what is going to be in your rational self-interest. I really think these things I'm talking about doing with old baggage, to get rid of old baggage, I don't think this can be done without a rationally selfish methodology. I've talked a little bit about this book. Well, the breakthrough came when last fall, when I realized I needed to reduce the concept motivation. And all of my views about motivation, all of my views about how do you manage motivation, how do you set goals that motivate, all of that presupposes that you have made rational decisions and set rational goals. It presupposes that you have an idea of what is in your rational self-interest and that if it's not in your rational self-interest, you're not going to do it. It's like, I don't think we can even have the science of psychology without a rational ethics, because there's no way to explain, the problems except in the context of some values are rational and some things that people act against and keep are not rational values. And that they mess you up. If you act to gain and keep things or you act to destroy things, that actually messes up your psychology. So this is sort of what you're getting here is sort of my my views on motivation in relation to ambitious goals. This is, I really think I have a complete theory of motivation at this point. And as I said, it all presupposes rational decision-making. That's what the first book is going to be, is rational decision-making, which is all about how to think, how to manage thinking, how to identify your values, and how to make decisions based on what is the biggest value as opposed to what's the least bad threat. Here's a big part of the message for you. You are the only person who can figure this out for you. Your goal, if you have an ambitious goal, it's unique. If you have any contributions to the problem, you are really the only person who can figure that out. That requires things like being honest with yourself about, did I try as hard as I thought I did? Like, one of the ways that I've made progress here is realized I really did try as hard as I could and I failed. Therefore, there is some skill I'm missing. Now, I have to say, trying as hard as you can, beating your head against the wall for a long period of time and then failing is very painful. And I do not recommend that you take that approach. I took that approach for years. And it was because I took that approach, I finally decided something is wrong with this approach because this does not work. This totally demotivates me. So what am I going to do differently? I took seriously, I must be contributing to the problem somehow. And that was part of what led me back around to find a different way of approaching how I use the just try method, just try harder and do it as hard as you can. And I tell you, I totally destroyed my, you know, I would get sick is what would happen. There was a limit to how much I could do before I was just ruining my health in various ways. And then I got afraid of ruining my health. So you need to be able to see sooner rather than later what's your contribution to the problem. And part of that is there's no substitute for your being honest with yourself, looking inside. An outside person can't do that. You know, I'm going to introduce my head coach for the Thinking Lab, Lynn Zinser, in just a second. And one of the things we talk about is, you know, we can make suggestions of things that might be going on. That can be very helpful in a coaching situation, but we do not know what is going on in your head. And someone who understands these issues can make suggestions, say, is it something like this? Is it something like this? What do you think it is? But the person who needs to answer those questions is you. And the more you can answer those questions for yourself, the more you can unleash yourself to go. But this means that you need to be able to introspect. The other thing, I mean, there's now two levels of membership in the Thinking Lab. There's the regular level, and then there's the mentoring level. And the mentoring level has a couple of perks. And one of them is that they can get quick 10-minute phone calls with me. And I have one scheduled at 5 p.m. And I am pretty darn sure that the issue there is that my mentee is not really clear on what is in his selfish interest. He's got a logical idea that that family should do make a certain decision, and he's really unhappy about it, but he thinks it's logical. And I don't think he's completely in touch with what's in his rational self-interest. We're going to talk about that at 5 o'clock. But this is something that what's really in your rational self-interest is the thing that meets all of your needs. And a lot of very good people who are pro-reason will come up logically with decide that this is what they need to do. And then there's a kind of subtext and it doesn't matter how I feel. And I think that is the biggest mistake. That is going to undercut. I mean, I did that. The reason I teach these skills is so you don't have to make the mistakes that I made. That's why. Save all this pain and suffering that I went through for, you know, I don't know, 15 years, something. I mean, it's been 30 years. That's enough time to have made a whole lot of mistakes, figured out what was wrong, changed them, figured out how to teach a better way, get really good at it. 30 years is a long time, guys. And selfishness, rational selfishness, is the key to solving every problem. But it requires a skill. You've got to get good at being able to tell when you have any contrary motivation. You need to be able to get good at really getting to the bottom of it. And not just, you know, there are all sort of things that we learn in the culture from parents and friends and movies where you just got to grit and do it, or all kinds of things like that. And it takes extra monitoring. It takes a willingness to pause and then, you know, in the heat of like a real emotional turmoil, to step back and say, okay, where is this coming from? You need ways to deal with the overload. You need ways to, I mean, sometimes it's hard to introspect this stuff. Sometimes you don't really know where it's come from. Because you really, the goal is meet all your needs. The idea that it's either or is, I think, also a mistake. A lot of times it seems like, well, I either can have time, timeliness or quality. It's either or. Whenever you get into that kind of either or thinking, that's where sometimes they say you shouldn't do black and white thinking. Of course you should do black and white thinking. But that's where, in the values issue, where you think it's only one value or another, that's where it's almost always a mistake. Usually you need some creative thinking to figure out what is the third alternative. And there's a way to get what you want in a way that you can be happy about it. Now, the fundamental concept here is motivation by love. This is what really broke through all, integrated and broke through all of the motivation issue that I, motivation material that I teach. I gave a talk on this at Ocon about, it's now 6 years ago. And I realized, yeah, this actually, by doing that talk, I actually realized, oh, this pulls together more things than I thought it did. And I've been focusing on that. And I call it orienting to values, because you can ask about this in the Q&A. When you say motivation by love, it makes it sound like you go with what you love. And it's definitely not emotionalism. It's the opposite of emotionalism. It requires introspecting every emotion to understand the values at stake built beneath it. It's a very cognitive process, and it's a process of really developing deep self-understanding. And the key thing, when you have an ambitious goal and you're growing your skills, there's going to be self-criticism. How many people here are liable to criticize themselves? I mean, who isn't, right? And what you need to be able to do is you need to be able to have that criticism. Why didn't you figure this out before? That was dumb, right? Okay, so hold on here. Let's get value-oriented. Good, I figured it out now, isn't it? What happened before? What insight can I get from not having figured it out before? Oh, that's a good insight. That's what the value orientation is. Same facts, different perspective on the same facts, one that strengthens you and puts you in a stronger position to go and achieve your goals. Doesn't deny any facts, doesn't ignore any facts, doesn't pretend anything that's bad isn't bad, but does figure out, okay, given this situation, this is bad. What is important to me in this situation? What's my way forward given that bad fact? That's what the value orientation is. Audrey says, Jean, can you compare and contrast your new perspective of old baggage with the old perspective? So what I meant, so the old perspective was, this is something wrong with me and I need to fix it. And my new perspective is, okay, this is the state of my psychology right now. I have this goal. How am I going to get this goal? Given the state of my psychology now, what are the steps that I can take now? What are the steps that I can take that are going to gradually retrain the psychology, you know, so that it's easier? What kinds of intermediate goals would help me develop the capacities that I need to be able to do this? It's all a goal-oriented method, with the current state of your psychology, including quote unquote old baggage, being part of where you start. You know, you start from where you are. You don't spend your time repining about, oh God, if I had just done this when I was six, my whole life would be better now. No, you know, say you're 40 now. Okay, I'm 40. This is what I got. How am I going to go do great things in the next 20 years? That's the difference. It's realism about it, but not feeling like this is something that needs to be obsessed over or felt guilty. I mean, if there's earned guilt, you should feel the earned guilt and and repair whatever you did. You need to do that. But just the fact that your psychology is a particular way is not something to feel guilty about. All right. So I've been talking kind of nonstop. I'd like to introduce Lynn Zinser. Lynn, would you unmute? So Lynn is the head coach of the Thinking Lab, and she does the one-on-one private coaching. She does all the one-on-one private coaching. I do most of the group coaching. She sometimes does group coaching. And I'm curious, actually, did you have anything you wanted to add to anything I was saying there? I'd just give you an open invite to put in your two cents here.
I was going to until you circled back around about value orientation, because that I think is what's really important in the whole setup of the Thinking Lab, that's what we're focused on, is being value oriented and not focusing on fears or self-doubt or any of that negativity. And which is, you know, new to me of about 6 years, because right. About 6 or 7 years ago, I called myself the queen of negativity. And if there was a negative thought I could have about myself, I had it. And then that's about the time that I think that you reoriented kind of
right.
This. And although it was talking about a lot of the same tools and all, it was a different way of framing it. And it's not true that I never have a negative thought anymore. But now, when I have a negative thought, I quickly transition to, oh, another one of my old thoughts coming up. Now what? Okay, so why is that coming up? What's going on here? And what can I do? And it within, you know, within a very short period of time, I'm back thinking about, well, how can I go forward here, as opposed to focusing on how I can't do anything because I procrastinate all the time, or I never get things done, or I always fail at this. I don't think that anymore. I just don't think that anymore.
Yes. So you see, I totally agree with you. And I decided that I should focus this talk on the issue of rational selfishness, because I think that's the big aha. It's like the methodology is the orienting to values. But the real thing is that if you want to be ambitious, it's got to be selfish all the way down. Your goals have to be completely selfish. And then how do you actually do that, I think, is the value orientation. And from what Lynn just said, you know, it's not when you have the self-criticism, you don't say, oh, well, that's self-criticism, I don't do that anymore. You say, why did that come up? Gee, what's going on here? You assume if you feel a fear, you don't say, oh, well, I don't feel fear anymore. You say, well, so what am I afraid of? Is there some threat there that I should pay attention to? And what is going on there? And what's the value? You treat it all as all this negativity as stuff that are alerts that, hey, maybe that needs a little more attention here. And oh my God, that is so freeing. It is just a much more benevolent way to go through life.
Right. And one of the things that I love about the Thinking Lab is that all of the tools, and you have courses, and all the tools are there that people can jump right in, join and jump right in and start using these to achieve their goals very quickly on their own.
Yes.
In fact, I don't even recommend that people start coaching with me until they've been in the Thinking Lab for a couple of months.
And tried some stuff out themselves.
And tried some because some people are very good at just being able to run with it and go, and they'll show up at classes and you can see how it's affected their life and they're changing. Other people, like me, I needed coaching for a while. So still do occasionally.
Yes. And I think everybody needs coaching sometimes. So let me just say that the goal of this class, you know, because this is a freebie to try, we want to promote the Thinking Lab, but we really want to promote, we offer a free 20-minute consult with Lynn to see if the Thinking Lab is right for you. So we're hoping you're going to take us up on that. I've just put in the chat the direct link to that. There's a page and you just fill it out and say, I'd like a free 20-minute consult with Lynn. And she'll tell you, she'll show you behind the scenes what's in the Thinking Lab, and she'll talk with you a little bit about your goals. And it's amazing what you can do in 20 minutes. You see, if you think this actually might be a good fit for you at this time. And it's free. There's no obligation. So I'm putting that in the chat, and that will also be in the, it's on the sales page. If you just go on the site for the page for the Thinking Lab, at the bottom of the page is the form. You know, another thing that occurred to me when you were talking about that, Lynn, we're kind of segueing into the Q&A part here, and I see one in the chat, I'll definitely answer. Something you said made me realize how the value orientation is different from the more standard thing, like the old cognitive behavioral therapy approach was find the distortions, right? Find distortions in your thinking. And like with the things you were saying, like, I always procrastinate, I never get things done in time. Those are almost certainly exaggerations. And it is very helpful to catch that the thoughts going through your head are false. But it's even more helpful to realize that those thoughts are activating an entire threat-oriented context that makes it more difficult for you to figure out the positive way forward.
Right.
And true thoughts can activate that context. So it's actually, it turns out to be more fundamental qua motivation to tell whether a thought is threat-oriented than to tell whether it's true or false. Now, obviously, you want to know if it's true or false, but for motivation, you need to know whether it's triggering a threat context or a value context. So I think that's a really big deal. Some people are saying goodbye. So I hope you found this helpful. As I said, the key point to take away is what you need to know in order to pursue ambitious goals, what you need to be able to access your rationally selfish motivation. That's what you need. And so if you have ambitious goals, or you have ambitious longings, but not goals, that's what you need. And that's what the methodology in the Thinking Lab helps you with. All right, well, why don't we turn to questions at this point? I see in the chat, there's a question from Rashid. Handling setbacks in the context of, let's say, team breaking, loss of momentum while working towards a shared goal. So am I correct about this? You want to know how this applies to team situations?
Yes.
Okay, so they are a little more complicated. So I think you need to look at two parts of this. One is your part of the team, and the other is, if you're the leader, how you apply this to leading the team. And so which one is are both of these relevant to you, or is one in particular relevant to you?
Mostly you're the leader, and you know where you want to go. And so just for context, I'm a startup founder.
Okay.
And you know, major setbacks such as like a key person in the team just leaving when, oh, you're like, oh geez, just the momentum was just building. We got to just go get it done. And the kind of, you know, how do you handle setbacks and your own psychology in that particular regard?
Right. So part of it is that you need to manage, because if you start awfulizing about, oh no, how are we going to ever get at this without this team? You actually won't be in a place to be able to think straight and think creatively about how to lead the team. Right. So the first part is you've got to be able to manage your own motivations and be able to see, yeah, this is a problem. I mean, because it is an objective problem if you lose a team member. Let's see, how do I give an actual statement that's not just vague here? Okay, I think this will help concretize. Like, for example, in that moment, there could be several different things that would be quite overloading. Like one of the things would be like, why did this person leave? And was there anything I did that contributed to this person leaving, right? Which is a whole set of stuff that actually probably does need to be examined at some point. Because if there's something you're doing that's causing the key person on your team to leave, oh my God, that is going to be really helpful to figure out so that it doesn't happen again. And that could be, if you have any worries in that regard, that could really be pulling you off and spinning you out. So you may actually need to do some thinking about that first and actually get a lead on, is there something, or is there, and maybe talk with the person if you have a good relationship with them, actually get feedback from them and find out, is there anything I contributed to this? So that you can put it aside, because the real priority at this point is actually getting some more momentum, right? So that is going to be requiring you probably covering for this person who's not on your team. I mean, I'm just making this up, not knowing the details. that's going to require some real creativity on you on figuring out how do we do, what do we do now, given we don't have this person. You actually are going to need to change your plan for what's next. And that's going to require all of your creative thinking, right? So the critical thing there is to get clear, okay, this is bad, and this is what I want to do. Given this bad situation, what is the goal I want to set, and how are we going to get there? And it's that mental shift that requires you to be able to ground yourself emotionally and also get in touch with all the values so you see what is most important right now, given the new situation. Because the priorities have changed, right? The priorities, the day before the person left, the priorities were one thing. The moment that person says, I'm leaving, the priorities have completely changed. And this is normal. I mean, priorities, it's really nice to set your priorities for the year. But if your priorities for the day actually stay the same for the day, it was a very uneventful day. Things happen, and you need to actually be able to get back in there without going crazy and figure out, okay, given this, what's the new priority? Now, that's a little bit vague, but does that help address the question that you asked?
Yeah, somewhat.
Okay. And then there's a separate, so that's really you managing your own motivation in that situation. Then there's a separate part of it is how do you lead the team in a value-oriented way? Because they may get very discouraged and say, well, we're never going to be able to get it done. And you need to actually, as the leader, you need to have actually figured out a value-oriented way to look at the situation of this is how we're going to go now. It's not the end of the world. Yes, this is bad, but this is not the end of the world, because you need to be able to communicate that to them so that they don't get all discouraged. Did you have something you wanted to add there, Lynn?
I was going to say that you may need to do a little bit of mourning with the team about the loss of that person and that they were important, or however the whole team looks at them, and to address that issue head on is what I guess is what I'm saying. And then, but this is how we're going to go forward, and this is what we're going to do to make things good.
Mourning turns out to be an incredibly important process. It's how you get clear on the values you've lost. And so, like when you have a key team member who's working with you, it's really easy not to appreciate everything great that they're doing. You just, it's part of the situation. And when you really sit down and oh no, we're not going to have this and this and this, suddenly when you lose them, you can think of all those things, right? I mean, this happened even when I lost my mother. I learned new things that I loved about her after she died. And I had a very good relationship with her, but things come up that were in the background, and it takes extra work to notice them. I mean, that's actually one of the challenges of being a manager is figure out what your people are doing right. And when you lose them, you get a whole bunch of emotions that help you lead to that. That actually is gold, because for one thing, it will help you understand what you're needing, like in the next person or among the team. Like if this person was the best organizer on the team, and you realize, wow, and now there's this and this that needs to be organized. I'm just trying to make up an example here. Well, that becomes really clear about where you need to put your priorities to help deal with the team in the short term. The more clear you get on what you've lost, the easier it is for you to find other ways to gain that same kind of value in some other form. And that's what mourning is about. Good for now?
Yeah, thank you so much. Yes, excellent.
Okay, great. Thanks, Rashid, for the question. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. Raise your hand if you have a question. I see a number of people have had to leave, which is totally fine. And I'm looking to see, I don't see any other questions. So who has a question? You can also get coaching if you want. So I mean, maybe it'll be a short Q&A this time. We'll see. I'll be quiet and see if I've got another question.
Ellen has.
It looks like Ellen wants to ask a question. Go ahead and unmute.
It's a question of Lynn. Lynn, you have this amazing card that you keep near your desk, and I wonder if that would be worth sharing.
Yes, except that I was just looking for it, and I think it's with my conference materials, because it's a card that says in big letters, "Are you being selfish today?"
That's right, because you
use
that
three different ways. It's a question asking about self, whether I'm being selfish, because I that's one of the things that is the most common thing is that I, you know, a little bit of altruism will sneak in. So
it comes in, it undercuts, and you feel like you have to sacrifice yourself, and you don't even realize it's happening because you spent the first 10 years of your childhood thinking that was a good thing. Right. Right. Yep. No.
Susie's got it up. If you raise it a little high,
Susie has her own version of it. Okay.
Are you being selfish? Is this a rationally interested action? And could this action be more selfish?
Yes. Right.
All right. Fair enough. Good. Okay. Well, I'm not seeing any other questions, which is totally fine. I've got things to do and you probably do too. So we are going to draw a line here. Thank you guys for coming. But let me put in the chat one more time. You know, we would love to have some of you join the Thinking Lab, and there's a lot of material. And I'm not doing an intro to the Thinking Lab. I'm trying
and
to
come for a 20-minute free consultation.
A free consultation, and Lynn will show you behind the scenes and give you a little bit of advice about your particular situation.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, and have a great day. Bye bye.
Bye. Thanks, Dean. Bye. Thanks, Lynn. That was great. That was really great.